You're listening to the Food Talk Show. Hello there, my name is Sue Nelson, and for the next hour, we're going to be eating and drinking stuff. I love saying that, as opposed to where we're talking about food, because never are we happier. That's Ollie and Guy and myself when a guest brings food in, aren't we?
And drink.
And it's good food and good drink, I hope.
We always have good. To be fair, though, we always have good food.
We rarely have bad food and bad drink.
Very, 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 very rarely.
There were those dehydrated vegetables someone once brought in.
Dehydrated vegetables?
Oh, that was me.
Oh, yeah.
Stop it. That's really mean. So I'm joined by my fellow presenters, Guy Routledge of Sapling Digital and co-founder of Food Rush, and Ollie Lloyd of Great British Chefs. Ollie, before we welcome our lovely guests, how's it going with your cookbook? You did some crowdfunding at Great British Chefs, didn't you? And people who were part of crowd, it's quite an unusual thing to do, bought into a cookbook that you're producing.
Yeah, so we raised about £110,000 from about 5,000 people who committed to basically buying a cookbook that didn't exist.
Brilliant.
So we then went and spoke to our chefs, and we've now got about 55 chefs, about 125 recipes. And we've been cooking all the recipes in the office, which has been awesome. And last week was our first week of shoots. So we were in a studio and we shot, I think, 25 dishes. And the team were very happy. And the images are out there on Instagram and Twitter and stuff. So you can still buy the book. And it's going to be dropping into the UK sometime in the summer.
But food photography is actually quite hard, isn't it? Because when you've got close up, when you've now got these amazing cameras, it will pick up if it's slightly soggy or if you want steam, or, you know, it's quite a difficult thing to do. It's a bit of an art, isn't it?
It is. But I think, you know, one of the things that we kind of are committed to sort of producing food and photographing it rather than producing, you know, chickens which have been covered in hairspray and then, you know, spray painted.
Some of the things they do are crazy, aren't they?
Yeah. Hmm. So we don't do that stuff.
I'm really looking forward to that. As I'm sort of one of your friends, am I allowed to say that?
Yeah, you are. Yeah.
Am I allowed to have a copy when it arrives?
Yeah, you can buy one. I'll send you the link.
We weren't going to get away with that, were we, Guy?
We got a free copy of Sue's book, to be fair.
Yeah, that's true.
We did. Okay, Sue gets a free one. Guy, I'll send you the link.
Oh, thanks very much.
So we're joined by our guest today, Cosmo Caddy. Great name. Much nicer than Sue Nelson. Cosmo Caddy of Still on the Move. Welcome to the studio, Cosmo.
Thank you very much.
And the reason why everybody's smiling is because you're a distiller of drinks.
That's correct. Yes, we have been making grappa for a while, but we're now with Still on the Move. We're making gin on the move.
Gin on the move. We're going to hear it all about that. And we're also joined by Claire Brumby, who used to, she founded, I think, Scrubby's Crisps. And that's kind of you, because you're no longer with Scrubby's Crisps, but you bought some in for us. Goes perfectly with the gin, may I say.
You enjoy them.
Yeah, very good. You're now, with all sorts of things, really, but you're particularly good at advising businesses, food businesses, on how they sort of get bigger, get into the supermarkets and stuff like that. So we'd love to hear some of your advice later.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, Cosmo, let's start with you. Now, you lovingly rescued and restored Ginny, a 1973 Volkswagen pickup, and you've turned her into a moving gin distillery. Why haven't you got a proper job like other people, Cosmo?
Well, you see, I had a proper job for a little while. I worked in television. That's not a proper job either. But people say that drove me to drink.
Yes.
And so, it was a while ago, 2013, I started up distilling. Grappa was the first thing that we started, and that was all fixed and in a distillery at home. But grappa took a while to get off the ground, and so we thought, why not try and do something that's a bit more accessible? And everyone was making gin. Didn't really want to try and have the competition and all the fight with the marketing and this and the other for making our own gin. But from my TV background and events and all that sort of stuff, I really liked the idea of taking things to people, letting other people create their own product.
And before we go on to the gin, you know, the moving gin, what exactly is grappa?
So grappa is traditionally an Italian spirit. It's made from grape skins after they've been used to make red wine. Or any wine, really, but red wine generally. And you take the skins because they've been fermented on the skins. They have the alcohol in them. You steam up those skins, get the alcohol out, and it's a lovely after-dinner drink that the Italians would have. And I think it's a sort of testament to the size of the English wine industry that we have now, that the offshoot industries such as grappa are now kicking off, and we are still the only grappa producer.
So is it slightly bitter?
Not bitter. It's somewhere between a vodka and a brandy.
It's lethal.
It is often known as fire water, yes. But there are different qualities, I would say, of grappa. There are sort of the free bottle you get put on the table when you're on a skiing holiday.
I think that's the only time I've had it, which I remember it just being disgusting.
It is very much an acquired taste, and I do say it's somewhere between a vodka and a brandy, but it is a very unique taste.
But if you presumably like anything, if you're making it properly with really quality ingredients, it's completely different.
Absolutely. I mean, we've been at international competitions and we give the Italians a run for their money because we focus on fresh grape skins coming to us as quickly as possible, so we're making a quality product. And again, that is very key because you can't come out with something these days in a very competitive market and bring something not good to market and expect to do anything.
And is there a British desire for grappa? Sorry.
Well, I'll say, have there been other wine-producing countries that have done the grappa thing as well? Is that
There's generally a grappa in any wine-producing country. So, I mean, you'll get Pisco in South America, and then you've got Eau de Vies in France, Palinka in... sort of further east and things. So
it's the same thing, they just call it a different thing based on wherever it's from.
That's it. I mean, grappa is a PDO, so it's a product of, like champagne, a product of designated origin. You can only make grappa in Italy, which is why ours is called Dapa, because it's made in Devon.
Nice. It sounds very British as well, doesn't it?
Dapa. Nice. Are you a fan at all, Ollie? No.
I'm not a massive fan, I have to say. It's not something, I mean, I have a lot of different spirits at home. It's not one that I would have. I do accept the fact that there is good grappa and bad grappa. I was once challenged to this fact and given some good grappa, and I kind of got it. But it's a proper, you know, punch at the end of a meal.
Absolutely. It is, and that's the thing. It is having it at the end of a meal, I think, is quite an important part, because you will have had some wine with your meal probably, and it's very good acting as a digestive. So, I mean, but if you're not a brandy haver or something like that, then it is a strange one to suddenly throw in there.
It sends you to bed.
I don't think I've had a huge amount of it. I've actually tasted this one before. Our producer, Lucy, was peddling some of it behind the scenes last time we were recording.
So I didn't get any of that.
A sneaky sniff.
The contraband trade that goes on.
And it was quite nice.
And what's all this about a digestif? Is it utter rubbish, you know, the fact that you need a bit of brandy or something just to, you know, calm your stomach off? You had a big meal.
Until I started drinking grappa, I didn't believe that at all. But it is amazing. I had it at Christmas the first year that we made it. And you have that heavy Christmas dinner. And you think, I couldn't possibly fit in pudding or cheese. Have a quick round of grappas for everyone. And suddenly, ready for pudding. Definitely.
It wakes you up and gets you ready to go
again.
It sounds
like it's a functional ingredient. This is excellent. Allows you to have another course.
It aids digestion. So not only is it, I keep saying to people, eco-friendly because we're taking a waste product and upcycling. Mm. So you're saving the planet by drinking, but it's also a health aid because it's helping your digestion.
It ticks all the boxes.
It does. Yeah. So your background before we go into what you're currently doing at the moment, I mean, you used to be part of the Nelson Mandela Foundation and look after their broadcasting of their fundraising concerts around the world. What was that like? I mean, as an experience, literally, did you go around the world?
I literally went around the world. We did a documentary about HIV and AIDS, which literally took me flying around the world. But a lot of trips down to South Africa and, getting to be a part of all these fundraising events that they were doing. I was doing it for about 4.5 years. And it was phenomenal. And it gives you a huge perspective on life as well, how lucky we are to live here as opposed to in certain parts of the world. But it is an amazing, amazing world to be in, and we did a lot of good as well.
And then you moved to California. Bearing in mind it's freezing here today, why are you here?
California was great and I loved it there. I've got family out there, so I was staying out there, and it wasn't quite England. I mean, it was lovely and I had a lovely time, but I probably wasn't doing as much work as I should have done and everything else. So I think it was my mum then got poorly, so I had to come home and be the dutiful son and look after her.
But again, in TV and film,
TV events, film, bit of theatre as well.
And then you sort of were drawn back to Devon, which of course is a beautiful place, although the roads could do with a bit of improvement, but you know, it's a beautiful place. Why did you suddenly move from you know, Nelson Mandela Foundation and doing good and all film and TV, then deciding to move into grappa and gin?
Well, my grandfather started Sharpen Vineyard down in Devon pretty much the year that I was born. And so I was picking grapes in a vineyard when I was 4 years old. And so I've always been connected to it and always liked sort of going and being a part of the harvest or the going to shows, selling it and things. So I always knew that that was around. And again,
that's a little bit theatrical, isn't it? That's your sort of film and TV background, a little bit.
I know. I mean, again, it's a lovely part of the world. I mean, yeah, South Devon and Sharpen, my grandfather's place, is beautiful. And so it's very picturesque. And at the time, it was one of the larger English vineyards in the country that was making sort of proper, decent English wine. And for a long time, won best red wine in England and all that sort of stuff. And sort of, but it never really grew and it's just stayed making the great stuff that it still does. But other vineyards have now come along, been planted and are vastly bigger in size than Sharpen.
And gin is obviously incredibly competitive. Claire, with your background, I don't know if you've got any clients that are in gin, but you've got to be remarkable, haven't you, to stand out in that sector right at this point in time?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, we were talking earlier on, it's exploded, the gin category. So yeah, you do. I don't have any gin clients at the moment, but yeah, you would have to really work with them for a point of difference to make them stand out. But Cosmo was talking about a fantastic seaweed gin earlier on, and that sounds really appealing.
So you've got to stand out, otherwise, you know, nobody's. I mean, it's just a plethora, and of course, the taste has got to be amazing. That's a given.
Well, that's it. The taste of your gin needs to be great, but again, it does often come down to branding on a massive. I mean, it's hugely important because I go to lots and lots of trade shows and consumer shows, and it is stall after stall after stall of gin, and you can see people walking past, and it's sight is the first thing that catches people, and you need to stand out and look different before you taste different.
Yeah, so, I saw a collagen gin now, you just reminded me, at Speciality Fine Fair last September. That was a gin with collagen in it, and that was a really USP.
They were on our show, actually.
It looked fabulous.
Yeah, but they're marketing girls, and they're from that industry. They really sort of know what they're doing, and they're having fun with it. They know it's a bit of a joke.
Came through, you could
really
see.
They sort of know what they're doing in terms of the marketing, which is great. So you've bought us some little bottles there. Can you right in front of me?
Yes, they're right here. So we've brought
what
in,
have we got?
I brought you three different gins. So as again, with our mobile still, we go around and we make different gins for different clients. We've done about 85 different gins since April last year.
And this is in your VW little...
Yeah, in Ginny, the 1973 VW, which has our still on the back of it, our still called Prosperity. And so we've done everything from weddings and parties to some restaurants and bars that then have it repeating over and over again.
So you turn up and what people are buying from you is the experience of making their own gin. Is that right?
That's it. So we have bars and restaurants that might want their own house gin, and we can provide that to them at similar prices to most craft gins, but we get to park up and create an event for them outside. They get to choose their botanicals from those that we carry on board, and then they're there for the whole process, and they can be part of the bottling. They design their own label, and they have a great time with it, and they get to promote it on social media. Lots of places that we go to, even if they're bars that want to sell it behind the bar as a shot, they're pre-selling bottle sales as well. And so they'll quite often have covered their costs
before they
in pre-sales
start,
before we even turn up.
That's smart amazing. Way to do it.
Good idea.
Very nice idea.
And the way that the gin is made on site or on the truck, is it that you've got like whole natural botanicals, or have you got like a concentrated distillation of the different ones?
They are all the actual botanicals, so juniper, brilliant, berries, star anise, angelica root, orris root powder, lemon peels, orange peels.
Fantastic.
Rosemary.
Pink peppercorns. Mm.
So if you want your truck to turn up, I mean, how much are people paying to get kind of, I can see a lot of our listeners going, I really want to get this guy to come along.
Food talk gin sounds like a good idea, doesn't it?
It does sound like a great idea.
How many bottles do you get, and what sort of pricing is it?
So it starts from 20 litres is the smallest quantity that we can do on the back of Ginny, which is 27 bottles, which is great for the weddings and the private parties. We did some Christmas corporate events and things, and we do team building exercises and things for corporate events. it's great,
Lucy brilliant. Over there is going, can we please have that for our next team building?
It's great. It has worked very well. The team has to work on a recipe together. We'll give them some guidance about what works together. Come up with your recipe and then go away and you do your presentations or your trust exercise or whatever. Come back and it takes 2 hours for that 20 litres to then be ready and in bottle. And then you can have designed your own labels. Each person can have their own customized label.
Wow.
And then
cool.
So roughly how much is that, you know, in terms of?
That is, I think, about £1,800.
Wow, that is so good. Isn't it?
It's not bad, is it?
It goes up in about £350 jumps every 20 litres after that.
Yeah. So basically you want to make sure you produce it. The margins kick in, or at least it's better for people if you get lots of gin.
That's it. I mean, so for the corporates and stuff like that and the weddings, it's often they don't want to have the big expenditure, but they don't mind spending £60 a person or something for a bottle of gin. But if you're looking to sell it behind the bar and make a profit on it, then yes, doing 100 litres, which is 140 bottles, is far more.
And that's economical. The maximum capacity.
That's the largest capacity we can do in one run. We did some recently for the Navy. We were on board one of their ships. They were doing it as a...
They haven't got enough problems already.
This was for a ship that is being decommissioned, and it's it was for the...
Rest the case.
To commemorate the great work that the ship has done, and we did two runs in one go on board on the flight deck of that.
Wow. So you're doing quite well in Russia doing it as vodka with the Russian Navy. That would be good, wouldn't it? Vodka, stunning.
They've also got enough problems.
Let's not get political, Ollie. So, I think it's a brilliant idea. Have you ever had anybody who's made, you know, as a team, the most dreadful, disgusting taste experience by just really thinking about what they're doing?
I try and touch wood every time someone asks that, because so far, like I say, we've done 85 gins and we've not made any gins that the client hasn't been happy with. They've always been very happy with it. There have been some that haven't necessarily been to my taste, but that is the lovely thing with gin, is that it is all very subjective. It's down to taste, which is why there are so many gins. One person I remember saying, oh, it tastes like, not our gin or their gin, but one that tasted like medicine to them, but their partner thought it was the elixir of life and thought it was fantastic. Yeah. Mm. So it can literally sway that much. And tonic is so important as well as to what
tonic goes with what.
Yeah, what happens with what.
And any that you've tasted and gone, oh, wow, that is incredible, I need to bottle that myself?
We've had a couple, and unfortunately the one that I made as a test, because you have to test these things, when we first got the still,
of course.
Is still my favourite. But I think a lot of people, what I found when we make these gins for people is they often think that their gin is the best gin they've ever tried. Yeah. And it often is, because it's been made for their palate, because we've included them in the process. But I still maintain that the one that I made on my own, and it was the best one that I've ever made.
But. Okay, so what have you got in front of us? What have we got?
So we've got three here. One we made for a hotel, and it's got apple and fennel that they foraged from their walled garden. And it's a very lovely gin, and we made it on site for them about 4 or 5 months ago, I think it was. And so we can try.
Yeah, Lucy, do you mind? You've parked your...
When you say on site, so do you put right up this there. Truck outside a bar, outside a house, and just everyone?
Yep, so we literally park up. So we did some in Bridport Town Centre, and we were parked up on the pavement outside the bar, and we have the alcohol goes in. We have a burner that goes underneath that heats up. We just need a water supply normally to cool it back down again. And so it's all contained within the size of our truck, pretty much. Although it then spills out normally when people want to try it and go and climb.
It looks brilliant though. There's some great photos on their website because of the vintage nature of the truck and the big copper pots and stuff. It looks really striking.
It certainly does draw a crowd. I mean,
I can imagine.
This one in Bridport, they had done some pre-sales, but in the 4 hours that we were there to make their gin, I think so many people came past, saw it, went in, and they snapped up all the remaining bottles that were left to.
Lucy, not that much tonic in mine, thanks, love.
It would go well with your medication.
No. I want to taste it as opposed to the tonic. That's all right. So just a tiny bit for me, thank you. Yeah, honestly. Well, some people say you should have...
It's good tonic, though.
Some people say you should have gin...
And water.
Gin and water.
That's my grandfather. That's a real World War II drink.
Mm. Is it?
Yeah.
Remember, we had Pippa Murray on and we had gin and water from our friends up in Scotland.
We did.
This is... Lucy, you give me one that's got nothing in it apart from the gin. I like that strategy.
Mm. And so when you've got your base spirit, presumably it's got juniper in, because otherwise it's not allowed to be called gin in the first place. Have you got a couple of base things?
Well, that's so we get in our very neutral alcohol, which is a grain-based neutral alcohol, and then into the botanical basket, which is, we heat up the alcohol, the vapour goes through the botanical basket, so it's a vapour infusion to make the gin. Some places do a mixture of vapour infusion and steeping.
Yeah.
We tend to just do the vapour infusion, partly because it's quicker.
Yeah.
You need to use more of your juniper botanicals and things like that. But it is quicker, but you can still get the same effect. So yes, we have juniper, angelica, and orris, the ones that generally go in as you're guaranteed three, and then after that, it's up to the clients.
And Claire, when you woke up this morning, did you think you were coming to Radio Studio to drink gin?
No, not at all. At,
what was it, 1:30 in the afternoon?
Not at all.
On a Monday? No. Your thoughts?
No, it's really not, actually. I was saying earlier on, I've not drank gin for a number of years, and this is my first try. I really like it.
Mm. I definitely get the fennel.
Mm. How would you describe this one?
So, again, it's apple and fennel are the two prominent flavours that will come on, as well as the juniper for the gin. And it's a very nice gin. They've done it because it's their shtick for their place is that it's all about grown in their garden or from a very local area. And so this was as much of the botanicals as possible, not the juniper, came from their gardens.
Mm, very nice. Mm. Guy?
Yeah, I'm getting the apple, but not so much the fennel, which I'm surprised at, because it's usually a much stronger...
It's got a little edge of fennel. It's probably because you got too much tonic in it.
And it was, one, interesting, we used fresh fennel rather than fennel seed as well. So it is a more subtle flavour.
Yes, that would make sense.
Mm. Next.
You don't need to pour pint glasses this time, you know.
No. So what have we got there?
This one we made for a local farm shop, and this was their spring detox gin that we did for them, which has got pink grapefruit and...
Oh, that sounds nice.
I'm trying to think what there was else in there. I mean, obviously your juniper, angelica, and orris, pink grapefruit, and I think possibly some lemon peel.
Lemon peel. So very citrusy, this one.
It's quite a citrusy one, and again, yes, should go very well with the normal tonic, or there are grapefruit tonics out there as well, so they tend to do that and then garnish with pink grapefruit and stuff as well, so they make it very grapefruity, but it's I think it's very nice.
I think my favorite tonics are made by Double Dutch. Do you know them?
No. Yes we have tried Double Dutch tonics.
They're quite strong tasting though. So maybe with some of your clients, in terms of, I mean, you wouldn't go with some of the stuff that they do, wouldn't go with the grapefruit, for example, but I really like what they do in terms of their tonics. Really.
No, it's very interesting. And again, the tonic market has become something crazy. I mean, it's 10, 15 years ago, you wouldn't even have thought of having
Schweppes, and that was it, basically. Possibly Fever Tree if you're very posh. But it's good to see that tonic is actually being treated as a real thing in its own right.
And that's even down in Devon where we are. I don't know if you know Luscombe Drinks, they've also brought out their own. So they've been doing fruit juices and things for a long time. Yeah. Now they have their own range of tonics as well. It just shows that people are very keen to get in on the gin market, which is still on an upward trend.
Now that's completely different in taste profile, don't you think? Very citrusy.
I really like that one.
Ollie, you're not sure?
No, it's delicious. I tell you, one of the things that I always find complicated about gins is that actually, if you buy, you know, 1 litre of gin or 750ml or whatever, you know, actually that lasts quite a long time. And actually, some of the fun of something like this is trying lots of different ones. And it's something that I think actually, you know, the sort of the dominance of that one pack size actually is kind of irritating, because part of the fun is, I think, tasting those different gins ones and trying them in different ways. Yeah.
Really, and the only time that you get it in a small bottle is when it's really crap. It's the really cheap stuff.
It is tricky. I mean, again, it's the economies of scale, I think, because we found that buying a 70cl bottle, which is a standard gin size bottle, and buying the 350ml version of the same bottle, it's only a penny cheaper for that bottle.
Wow.
For half the size. So obviously it's cheaper for the duty and the booze and stuff inside it. But because all of the bottles go out of the 70s, they don't make as many, so the demand and everything. So it is quite expensive to have.
And when you did your research recently at Great British Chefs, Ollie, was there anything in there about alcohol or was it just food? I can't remember.
We looked at cocktails, the number of people who made cocktails. But we've done previous research on what spirits people have at home, and gin does top the list. That is the one that people have. But I think, as we're seeing, you know, with people like Fever Tree launching into more sort of dark mixes and stuff, I think people are beginning to push out of gin as the core thing, which is why I think we're seeing more and more interesting stuff in the world of gin, and what you're doing, which is ultimately the experientialization, if that's even a word, of the gin thing, where actually you get to make your own gin, which, I mean, how cool
that's
is that?
That's fabulous. No, it's really cool.
There are a number of gin schools now that have popped up around
gin
the country.
Gin schools?
So you turn up and you can make, in a tiny little still, you can make one bottle of your own gin and things, and you generally get offers of gin and tonic while you do it. And it's actually something that we're looking to do as well.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, I've got to one.
Yeah, and it's a fascinating experience for people that like gin but haven't ever had an opportunity to go to a distillery or what have you and see it, and they can actually understand the flavours that go in. And yeah. If you can smell the botanicals individually, you can then, it's much easier to recognise them than in the gin that you're tasting afterwards. And I think people find it really, really fascinating.
Mm. What else do we have in front of us?
I have got one more
this
gin for you.
This might be my last one, otherwise I'm...
Don't we need to go to the rest of the program? Drapa.
Yes, we can get some Dapper. Yes, yeah, so I'll bring the levels
up.
Have some Grappa for you, but that will finish you off. So I'll one more gin first, which is our Navy Strength gin.
Navy Strength. What does that mean?
Yeah, so there's a long story behind Navy Strength. But this is what I've been told, and no doubt people might correct me. But Naval Strength gin all comes from the old days when, on galleons, when you had gunpowder for cannons. The gunpowder and the rum or gin was all stored in the same area. And so if a barrel of rum leaked onto your gunpowder, if it wasn't flammable, your gunpowder was then useless.
Yeah.
And so all naval rums and spirits would all have to be overproof, so they would have to be flammable, and alcohol is generally flammable at 50% by volume.
Wow.
At room temperature or sea sort of temperature. And so most of the world treats volume and proof as half of each other. So 100% proof is 50% by volume, generally. The UK Navy was the only one that went slightly off-piste with it, and they decided that 57% was a better way. That would be the measure, just to make sure. So, because if it gets extra cold or it's down in the Antarctic or something like that, then it still needs
air
to be
on
able
the side
to,
of caution. Exactly. And we're talking about a normal whiskey, a normal gin is around 40%, 37 to 40%. So it's significantly higher.
It's a significant jump. And there are obviously many distilleries in the UK now producing Navy Strength or overproof.
Hence, I suppose the song, "What Should We Do with the Drunken Sailor?"
What should we do with the drunken Sue after this moving thing?
Sue's currently lying down, actually, holding the microphone.
We
haven't even done the grappa yet, have we?
This is much more a London dry style, so it's a much more straightforward gin. So let's the juniper, and it's got a little bit of caraway in there as well, and some seaba berries as well.
And this is Navy Strength?
That's Navy Strength, so that's a 57%.
Can you talk while I'm drinking, please, Ollie?
I'll describe the scene. Sue is lying on the floor with a straw. It's, should we just say, it's recycled plastic. And she's consuming.
Topical.
No, I'm trying to. No, it's good.
It's nice. It's normally when you have spirits that are much stronger than your average, so, you know, more than the 40%, they just blow your head off. But
this doesn't blow your head
this
off.
This really doesn't. It's very smooth. It doesn't feel out of place with any of the others that we've had
so far. It's got very intense flavour, though.
Like you said, it's very simple.
But that's the thing. With the stronger alcohol, the flavours will be held in a lot more. And so the more alcohol, the more the flavours will be pronounced.
It's much stronger in taste as opposed to... Mm. I don't feel it's stronger in alcohol. I'm sure I know it is. But it doesn't feel
like it.
Just blow your head off. It's actually got some really nice flavours.
The lucky thing, or the very good thing for us, is that I've been doing distilling for 3 or 4 years before we... 5 years, in fact, before we started the gin. So I've got quite a background in that, and I think our grappa that we're about to try has been award-winning things, and so it gave us a good credibility, I think, to start with. So when we came out with the mobile gin, people trusted that we would make a quality product, and I don't think we would have got the licensing or been able to sort of convince a few of the more reputable places that we could come and make them a gin if we'd just started from scratch, just rocking up with a bus.
That brings up an interesting question, which is, what is the licensing for having a mobile distillery?
It's very complicated.
I'm sure it is.
Because it's British, it would be.
And we are still the only mobile gin distillery in the country, and it just took 2.5 years of working with the government to compromise on things so that they were happy with all our processes and we could report on every single little detail.
Mm. So you have to be... registered, do you, if you're producing alcohol?
That's it. So we've been registered as a distiller and rectifier and compounder since we started with the grappa, and it was a case of taking that on another step and working out with the
policy. And then that's because you get, as far as HMRC is concerned, you get very specific types of, you get taxed in a very specific way, and it's illegal to produce stuff unless you have this certification.
It is. You can't distill alcohol without a license. And so you can go and buy a still from Amazon or any other retailer, but it could only be used for essential oils or water. if you try and do anything with alcohol in it, even if it's for home use, you can't. Well, if you're using a still for it, even for home use, you need a license.
Right.
If you're just compounding, which is adding without the use of a still, so you make slow gin just by putting slows in, or you put a cinnamon stick into some vodka. Yep. As long as you're not selling that, you don't need a license.
So you can take gin that already exists, you know, some cheap gin or something from a supermarket, and then you can flavour it and stick, you know, homegrown raspberries or whatever it is in there, and you don't need a license for that, but you're not allowed to sell it.
Yeah. So you generally, yeah, that would be the general, you need to have it consumed on the same premises that it was made. I think that was what I read recently in HMRC. Mm. So generally, I mean, I think that? You can, well, exactly. Well, but I think it's to stop a factory sort of doing it and doing it and selling it to the local pub.
And is there a different sort of license if you're doing that as opposed to distilling?
So so compounding license would be if you wanted to do that. So that's just adding it without the use of a still. Or rectifying would be taking it and changing the flavour or the nature of the alcohol using a still is rectifying. And distilling is a harder license to get on top of that because you're taking something of a low alcohol strength and taking it up to a stronger strength. So you're converting something from, say, a cider to a cider brandy or grapes at 8% up to grappa at 42%.
When I was I used to be a lecturer a long, long time ago in a business school, and we used to have these huge, I don't know what you call them, containers where students could park their bikes, and you know, it was raining and all that, and it was all safe. And one of these guys, we rumbled, he actually had a still in there, was making alcohol out of potatoes, which I thought was pretty enterprising actually. But anyway, got thrown out for doing that.
Should have been given, lauded at a business school.
Given an extra,
extra credit.
If he got himself a license, was it then? He'd probably be okay. Absolutely fine.
Yeah, probably has. There's probably a punchline that actually he now owns.
Yeah. Probably, yeah. He probably owns.
It's William Chase.
Yeah, somebody like that. Shall we do the grappa then? And then we're going to have a break because I need a little lie down before we do the next.
While we pour the grappa, I just have one more gin question. I was at a gin festival recently and I kept seeing this thing called bathtub gin. Is that a different method of production, or is it just, you know, makes it sound kind of quirky and innovative, dirty?
No, it's a famous gin. It's a very famous gin, actually.
It is, and I believe it was the way that in the olden days you could, the wives at home would be making their gin in the bathtub.
It is a particular process.
And it's more a case that was much more steeping and probably more compounding rather than rectifying, so they'd be buying grain alcohol they'd have got from someone.
The bathtub gin's it's good. It's nice.
Is it, so is it
very
a brand?
Expensive? Yeah, it's a brand.
Right, yeah. Mm. Okay.
But it's very expensive. Is that the grappa?
No, no. I haven't got that yet.
Do hurry up, Ollie.
You need very little grappa.
Very little.
And I won't be offended if you don't like it, because it isn't for everyone.
Just saying here, Claire's just, her eyes have just gone straight to the ceiling. Ollie's just gone, and that's just smelling it. God, I can smell it from here.
Such a distinctive smell.
Haven't even lifted the glass up yet. It's very strong smell. What is it? Wow. Yeah, and it smells of alcohol.
Yeah, it really does. It really does take you to Italy. I mean, it is.
But it's very grapey as well. It's not like a vodka, which is just, you know, I don't even know how to describe vodka. It's so kind of, you know, it's got it's no real anything. But this
I'm
very
not
grapey.
Sure he wants to drink that. The smell is...
Do you know, I think that is a very, 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 very nice, not a grappa.
Thank you very much. No, and it is, and it's one of the very difficult things is that the smell often does put people off. Yeah. A lot of people will say that the taste is a lot better than the smell, and it is still quite smooth.
Because it smells quite brandy.
It smells medicinal, hugely, and it smells blooming strong. What percentage proof is that?
It's only 42 by volume, which I guess most people would say would 84% proof.
84% proof. Oh, my God. Okay,
you're in control of a radio station. Is there a law against drinking and broadcasting?
It's not heavy machinery, so we're fine.
I don't like that.
Don't you?
Imagine it with an espresso, and it's a very different experience. So it is very one that needs to be, general, as I said earlier, after
it
dinner.
It lingers
or,
a lot.
And it does, a long aftertaste.
Mm. I think it's got a nice finish. It's a very impressive finish.
Make me shiver.
Yeah. We should have had the crisps first, and then this would be after, you after
taste
crisps.
I think I might keep this before I head out into the snow.
Yeah, possibly. Actually, the aftertaste is okay. I'm getting that okay. Maybe I just need
is this the sous vide of alcohol? Is this, I started with, I didn't like grappa, and then, you know what I bought last week?
I mean, I quite like whiskey, actually. I'm not a great fan of brandy, but I quite like whiskey, and I think I'd probably... No, I don't want any more. Thank you, Lucy. I think I'd probably stick to that. But I'm warming up on it a little bit.
The second sip... someone that used to work for me a little bit used to say the second sip is always the one to improve it. And it is one of those things. It does grow on you. My good friend of mine lives next door to me, and it took him 6 months of my badgering to get him to drink it every time he came round. And he's now a big fan.
Right.
He's a whiskey fan as well, so it did take him a while.
I think it's that slightly soapy taste I don't like.
Mm. I mean, what
do you know what I mean by that? No, yes, no.
I'm just thinking back to some of the bad grappers. I'm on a journey.
Horrendous. Oh, this is undoubtedly lovely quality.
No, it is. Mm. But if you can imagine now what a really bad one tastes like. I mean, they're just
rougher.
It's really rough, and it's really just power.
Wow. So we can have a little break now because I need to get my act together. So we can have a little break. and we'll come back to talk to Cosmo Caddy of Still on the Move, if I can remember his name, when we come back. And Claire Brumby of Scrubby's Crisps. We're going to have to open Claire's Crisps, aren't we, to keep us going. So we'll be back in a couple of minutes.
Nice surprise, darling. Something to celebrate?
We've just got a very tasty government cash reward for innovation.
All that blood, sweat and late nights finally paid off then. How come?
Thanks to our buddies at Breakthrough Funding. Yeah! Sorry, just slipped out. It all sailed through painlessly in no time at all. Over 40k, thank you very much, and the planet will benefit too.
And new shoes for me? Cheers.
Your company could qualify for Innovation Cash too. Find out online now by answering just 6 qualifying questions at breakthroughfunding.com. Yeah!
And we're back in the studio, Food Talk Show. We've been drinking grappa and gin, which of course is just a normal part of my job. I'm feeling a little bit heady because the grappa in particular was incredibly strong. So thank you very much to Cosmo for that. Yeah, that's oiled the wheels nicely. And we're going to talk to Claire Brumby now. Claire, you haven't had gin for ages. What did you think? You weren't expecting that, were you, today?
No, not at all. Not at all. I really liked it. I was just saying I really liked the grapefruit one. That was really nice. No, I have not had gin for about 20 years.
Is that going to entice you back?
It quite possibly would, yeah.
Quite possibly would. Well, Cosmo's very kindly got a little bottle there, the grapefruit one. I suggest you take that home.
Yeah, perfect.
Isn't that very nice of him? Mm. So, Claire, you founded Scrubby's Crisps in 2012 with your husband, John.
Yes.
And then you sold it later on. Uh-huh. And now, because of your experience, and so many companies want to go through that process, you're now sort of an advisor to lots of people trying to do the same thing. And your founder and contributor of The Food Guide. I'm going to trip over my words quite a lot, just to warn you, because I've been drinking quite a lot of gin. So it's a sort of digital magazine, and lots of your topics are about, you know, entrepreneurship and all that sort of stuff. How did you start off founding that? Did you feel there was a real need for people to get some really practical, good advice?
Yes, and that's exactly what I offer. All my clients and everybody who I talk with, they want to they want first-hand experience, because I started the business literally with an idea from a market stall, and then took that to listings with Waitrose and Ocado and international listings. People actually want somebody who's felt the pain and who's grown through all that and know the pitfalls, because to be honest, you know, there's a lot of pitfalls to fall in, and I believe I fell in all of them. So
I think any of us who run a business can say the same, no matter what sector you're in, and that's the only way to learn often.
Yes. Mm. Yeah. So, but it's just nice that I can help my clients now, so I can sort of accelerate their journey. They don't have to make the mistakes. They learn from my mistakes. And they don't have to have, you know, as much pain along the way, because that's what I can help them with. So, yeah. So when we sold the brand, I thought, OK, so I've got all this expertise, all this knowledge. And that's what I've got a passion for now, helping people.
Mm. And there's quite a lot of business advisors around, and, you know, business mentors. I advise many businesses that we come across, because my normal job, we come across quite a lot of new businesses, that actually getting some mentoring and getting, you know, advice from somebody who's been there and done it is really important, as opposed to, and I know this is my own view, and I know a lot of people disagree with me, as opposed to somebody theoretically who you know, thinks they understand business and whatever, but actually haven't been in there and done it. And there is a place, of course, you know, for learning and you know, the sort of theoretical side, but if you want somebody to sit with you and take you through it, you need to be talking to somebody who's been there and done it.
I absolutely agree. And that's, you know, when people work with me, I've absolutely got their back. I'm on the journey with them. And it's through that pain of everything I went through in my journey. And that's what I'm really passionate about. And I didn't have a mentor when I did it. And I believe that's partly why I made so many mistakes. And yes, you know, you do learn through mistakes. But once you've got somebody, for instance, like me there, who can prevent as many, then that's what I'm here for.
I mean, the three of us presenting today, we all have our own businesses, we have our own day job. And Ollie, you're sort of chief exec of Great British Chefs. This isn't the first time you've had a business or been in business. And it does make it much easier, doesn't it, when you've been through those stupid mistakes yourself. And then when you set up again later on, or if you've been in corporates and you do it again later on, you know exactly what you're not going to do and what you are going to do. I'm not saying you don't make mistakes again, but you're a bit more prepared.
Yeah, I mean, the great thing is there are no shortage of mistakes to be made.
So, I agree with that.
Just because you've learned or you've got an advisor to help you, you know, maybe avoid a certain percentage. There's a whole new set coming out. And I think particularly in the digital world, you know, any rules that were probably true when you probably founded your business, you know, again, a lot of that has changed. Mm-hmm. None of the stuff is static. And I think that's in some ways where, you know, I think there are more and more communities of people who are there to help. But I always think actually in the world of food, there's a tremendous sense of generosity. And I think that, you know, a lot of people are not competing with, you know, gin manufacturers not competing with a crisp manufacturer. And actually, therefore, I think there are often some really good exchanges between people sharing. And I think that's, you know, I think a really important thing to do, as well as a more formal mentoring thing, as you say.
And Guy, as I was going to say, you're in, you know, you've got the Food Rush and CEO of Food Rush and stuff, and you've also got a digital business. Mm. Again, this isn't the first business you've had.
No.
But you know, I know you've tried different things, trying to get it right, trying to find the market, you know, and you have to keep reinventing yourself a little bit.
Absolutely. And it's the whole thing is a journey. And I think when I, you know, so I'm still relatively young, but I've tried a few different things over many years. And I think I always had this idea that, you know, building the business was the goal. And it's like, I just need to do this or this or this, and then it will be done. Whereas really, that's not it at all. The whole thing is the journey. And you have to learn to enjoy the process of making mistakes, and, you know, and then also enjoying the wins along the way as well. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's not straightforward, but it's great fun.
Not sure I'd say it was great fun. mostly it is, but I mean, it's not always. It's tough.
No,
it's,
absolutely.
You know, if anybody thinks it's easy running a business, you know, get real, because it isn't. It's hard.
No, it's rewarding though, and I think rewarding. If anything that's too easy is never going to be that rewarding in the long term. But
But you, I mean, I always remember George Osborne used to have this, you know, statement he used to make. He says, "We need more entrepreneurs in this country. People should start their own business." You think, you know, really? You know, actually, I think it's a bloody hard thing to do.
And I think, like George W. Bush when he went to France and said that the trouble with the French is they didn't have a word for entrepreneur. Did you know
that's
that
a brilliant quote, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. He's actually become a better president since he left. But anyway, that's all about comparison points. We're not going to politics. But I think, you know, there is, you know, there's so much to be learned along the way, and you've got to be prepared to pick yourself up. And I think that you have got to be someone who is prepared to, you know, I'm sure you spend a lot of time with your clients talking about how to take the punches and how to actually...
Yeah, quite a lot of what I do is working on the mindset, really, because, you know yourself, it's so hard. And when you get a knockback from a retailer, or you get a knockback on your commercials, or something goes wrong with your deliveries, or something goes wrong on your product innovation days, you know, a lot is keeping their mindset right, to keep slogging at it, and just to keep being that champion for them so they've got somebody to turn to, because a lot of entrepreneurs are solo founders as well. So, you know, if they don't have anybody, that's where...
I think that's really hard. It's a lonely place.
It's very lonely.
But I think so many people think that they have to do it by themselves, and they have to, you know, solve the problems as they come up, because that's what it is.
It's a sign of weakness asking for help, and it's actually not. It's a sign of strength. It's the other way around.
In many ways,
and that's where I was. I didn't reach out and ask for help. Mm.
But Claire, what I find though is if you've got a business and that, you know, you've got people working for you, and quite a lot of people working for you, they can't see you wobbling or wavering. They can't.
No.
And therefore, you don't necessarily choose for it to be lonely. And I'm doing my business on my own. I don't, you know, don't have any other shareholders or anything. And therefore, you know, it can be quite difficult. You know, and sometimes people don't know where to reach out, I think. Whereas if you're a co-founder, it's easier, isn't it?
Or when to reach out and what you're reaching out for. I mean, it's not, you know, I mean, that's one of the difficulties. I think, you know, what's interesting about what you're doing is you are helping food entrepreneurs largely. And therefore you have deep experience in that. But often, you know, if you're dealing with packaging problems or, you know,
Yeah, knowing the question to ask is really, really challenging. I mean, so I come from a tech background, and a lot of teaching people how to do technology, like writing code and stuff, is kind of Googling it. But when you say that to somebody, they don't get it, because they don't know what to go and search for. So it's about getting that mindset and about kind of knowing how to frame the question,
and
breaking it into lots of smaller pieces rather than the, you know, how do I build a business is the wrong question to ask.
Usually when you chat and you have these consultancy sessions with them, that comes through. They tend to somehow know. They know what they want, they just don't know how to get there. And this is where you help them to get there, with, you know, avoiding the pitfalls.
And Claire, at what point, you know, if you're really, you know, you're really, really going for it and you're constantly battling, at what point is it that you should actually give up? Because sometimes that is the right thing to do. How do you know that this isn't just not going to work? Or you're just, you know, you're just bubbling under and it is going to happen. How do you know that?
I think that's all down to the individual. And what I always say is people really need to really, really know themselves and have a deep understanding of themselves. I mean, along my journey, I remember being at an event where Tim Campbell was there. He was the first apprentice winner. And he likened it to being a fly against a window. And at some point, you have to stop flying against the window. But you have to just know that yourself. You have to understand yourself. If, you know, if you've tried everything, if a client came to me and they said, "Oh, I'm thinking of giving up," then I would go through, you know, what have we tried? Where are you with your cash flow? What's happening with your products? What are your sales looking like? How are you as a, you know, personally? How are things? How are things? And once you've drilled down through all those, then that's when the answers would then come. A lot of people feel like giving up when actually they just need somebody to talk to, or they just need somebody, that third eye looking in the business. And actually things maybe aren't as bad as they think they are. They're just having a down day, or they're just getting quite a few hits at one moment. And usually that's when the turn comes. You know, there's quite a lot of times along my journey when I was thinking I can't continue anymore. You know, this is crazy. This is too hard. You know, we all face that. We all face that. But I think you know yourself if it's something to work through and to keep striving for, or if actually it's something that you need to walk away from. And just having the conversation with somebody would help you come to that realisation.
Yeah. I mean, I sometimes work with insolvency practitioners in my business, not for me, I hate to try to put, and they will often say that when somebody's in trouble and they're getting themselves in debt, they often leave it too long before they go and see somebody like an insolvency practitioner, who will then try and help them unravel it. You've got to get help early, haven't you, if you're really struggling?
You have, yeah. But you see, I'm the eternal optimist, and I launched my business from a negative anyway. So a lot of people thought I was crazy. I'd been previously ill, and we got ourselves into some personal debt, and it was a real struggle to even get launched. So some people said to me, you know, you're crazy. You'll never get launched. You'll never get off the ground. So it's not to be knocked, that internal determination. And again, this is all about knowing yourself. You know, there are certain things in the marketplace which you could say, oh, you know, don't do it for this reason, don't do it for this reason. But if you've got that absolute sheer gut determination and drive and passion and will, then, you know, there are a lot of things you can get through.
Yeah, I mean, I do agree with that. But I think that we go to a lot of the shows, but particularly me and Guy, with the Food Talk Show, like Speciality and, you know, Food Matters Live. And, you know, I do worry about the number of people who, for example, will have an ice cream brand. And actually, for me, the differentiation isn't brilliant between some of them, actually, or a chocolate brand or whatever. And I do worry that the market's just not big enough for all of them.
I also worry that there's some unrealistic funding expectations out there. And I think one of the most interesting things is that people think, you know, they go onto Crowdcube or they go onto any of these crowdfunding platforms and they see valuations of £1 million for businesses with no turnover and no listings. And you think, oh, I can do that. And actually, I think there's a whole danger, I think, around this stuff, which is that there's some environmental stuff that's actually creating whole new worlds of problem areas that, you know, didn't really exist, you know, probably when you started in your business, actually, because people, there's expectation that you're going to create this thing's worth a fortune. You start fundraising and you get into the, I think you can get into quite a quick negative spiral.
But that's
spiral
because people make it look easy, and actually success isn't easy.
No.
And the people who do it well make it look easy, but it just isn't. And everybody's been through the hiccups that you're explaining,
yeah,
aren't they, Claire?
I'm currently writing my book and it's out later on in the year. And this is one thing that I cover off. You know, sometimes people should remain with their business as a hobby. You know, just because you're really passionate about brownies, it doesn't mean to say you're going to be the next, you know, innocent of brownies. Maybe you should just keep that as your hobby. And this is something that I do when I'm consulting. When people initially come to me with an idea, you know, I really drill deep down. Is it a hobby? Is it just something that you need to keep in your kitchen? Or is it actually got legs to let's take it commercial?
Or a lifestyle business where maybe, you know, you've given up your job, but you're quite happy. You just want to break even. You're not going to make a big, you know, and you never nice intend, businesses. You know, you don't, yeah. you've never intended to.
Yeah, no,
it's just a lifestyle that you love.
And there's definitely a time and place for that, I think.
Yeah, and Cosmo was just explaining, you know, I love going to the food fairs. I like being part of that community. You know, I love doing that in the summer. You know, that could be a great lifestyle business, you know, if that's
it, it is a lot of fun, yeah, absolutely. Mm. It's a great fun thing to do, and it's a lovely community. That I think the food and drink community is a very engaging and supportive,
friendly
community.
And supportive. Yeah,
it is equally as hard work, though. I mean, I remember for the first two or three years, we went to absolutely every single festival, market, food fair you can imagine, and we had all our three kids in tow as well. Oof. And you know, it was difficult, it was hard. So yes, it's a nice lifestyle. You get your kids to go to festivals and they get to, you know, taste all this amazing food, but it is hard work. It's not to be overlooked, the hard work aspect of it.
And
as
I've heard so many stories of like bad performance at these trade shows from the people who are going to them. Know, speculatively looking for distributors or looking for new business, they spend a fortune and they maybe get, you know, a couple of business cards and no follow-up. So it, you know, it can be very, very hit and miss, which
is
tough.
It can be a risk, but then, you know, it's down to doing your homework, contact some previous exhibitors and see if it worked for them. But usually when we went to any festivals, we did, you know, we kind of like covered all the costs and then some. But then we usually will pick up a stall, for, you know, sorry, a distributor or a deli or a farm shop or something from it. And it was also great sort of edible marketing. You know, you were right in front of your consumer, they were tasting them, and also then we could translate some of that data back to your buyer. So there is a time and a place, and if you use all that data effectively, then, you know, it can.
But that, I mean, that whole edible marketing thing, I don't think there's enough is made of this sheer impact of those, you know, those festivals. You know, if you're a founder and you spend, as you say, you know, the entire summer basically trawling around these places, flogging stuff, you basically are burning yourself out. And I think a lot of businesses find it difficult to jump from that sort of I'm in a Cardo kind of sort of space where, you know, the CEOs and founders are spending their entire time at Whole Foods, at festivals. And actually then, you know, do you actually have a brand you can actually then communicate
so when
and
do you
take
make
it to the next level?
You know, you're making it at 2 o'clock in the morning, aren't you? Because you're trying to fit it all in. Quite difficult. I can't believe we're coming to the end of a programme already.
Wow,
just
that's gone fast.
But just sort of real top tips for you. Make sure that there genuinely is a market and that you genuinely want to go into business and you know how hard it is. That's the number one.
Definitely. And really understand yourself, you know, and why you're doing it. You know, there has to be a why, which is bigger than just because I like brownies or just because I want to make some money. You know, why actually are you doing it? Is there a USP to your product? Is there a place in the marketplace for you? Have you got the cash to launch? How are you going to live and stay alive whilst you are running your business? Quite a lot, really.
And what about pricing? You've got to be sensible about your pricing, haven't you? I mean, it's great being premium pricing if your product's amazing, but you know, you're still up against a lot of competition, and you know, the sort of normal sort of supermarket grade thing might be half the price, and therefore somebody's just not going to make that leap to yours.
I think it's about understanding your category. It's about understanding your product and your ingredients and also your margins and then your category, and then tailoring that all to make the perfect ingredient for what you do bring to market. There's a lot involved, and a lot of people just have their idea on this premium product, let's say, but maybe there isn't a market for it, or maybe they're not going to be able to charge that amount of money for it. So then they can maybe look at the ingredients and look at all different aspects of that to bring it to market. So you do have to, you know, I think that one of the main things when clients come to me, they're overlooking a lot of the detail, and I always say the devil is in the detail, not only with the costs, but with the ingredients, with your routes to market, and with your distribution channels as well. So it all needs looking at in as much detail. Really.
And for me, the crunch comes as soon as you start employing people. It becomes deadly serious because you're responsible for them and their families and their mortgage, and it becomes deadly serious, isn't it? You know, the responsibility starts racking up.
But also, people are so much more expensive than you're selling a bag of crisps for, and so you've got to sell a lot of crisps to make somebody's salary. And that's where it becomes even more challenging, because that's that scale point. I think, Sue, we've talked about it before, you know, that whenever you're kind of bringing people on or you're looking for funding, it's a, you know, it's a scaling thing, and you've got to make sure you're scaling something that works rather than scaling something with a, you know, load of holes in it. Mm. Very challenging. But hopefully we haven't put anyone off.
No. Well, it's an important undertaking. No, absolutely, and if you are going to put your, you know, your house up, you know, against it, which a lot of people do, you know, and you know, if you're in a relationship, it's going to put pressure on that. You've got to know what you're in for.
You better know from the off, because you know, I always do say that, but you know, not paint the bleakest picture, because you know, as Cosmos said, there's a lot of fun to be had along the way. However, you do need to be realistic about it as well.
Mm. And Ollie, how many people have you got, Great British Chefs?
20,
yeah, same as me. It's a responsibility, isn't it, every month, knowing that you've got to pay
it is,
all these
and look, you know, we've raised 3.5 million quid to get us to where we are.
And you just said crowdfunding was ridiculous.
Well, we've got serious, you know, EIS investors who backed us because they believed in the journey we want and understand the risk they took.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's what these kind of guys do. But I mean, you know, you've got the employees, and then you are taking on people's money. And I think a lot of these kind of food-based businesses not only start with people's money, as in the individual founders, but also then family and friends and stuff. Mm-hmm. And that, I think all that stuff is a huge responsibility.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Claire, if anybody needs your help, where can they find you?
They can go along to www.claire.
That's that gin earlier.
Yeah, I know.
Gin.com.
Gin.com, yeah.
I should buy it.
ClaireBrumby.com. So on Twitter and all social handles, I am at FoodGuideClaire. And my website is clairebrumby.com.
And obviously we'll have a link from the Food Talk Show website, so you can go on there and find all that.
And watch out for my book coming out later on in the year.
She's quite good at marketing, isn't she? Cosmo Caddy of Still on the Move. Love what you're doing. Love it. You've entered the Food Talk Awards, haven't you?
We have entered, yes. Mm, looking forward to.
Yeah, yeah. And I think Lucy, our producers, are sitting at the end of the studio. She's really wanting us to have a team away day, aren't you, where we all make gin. So we may well be calling on you to trot
always
over
very
to,
welcome,
to our offices. So stillonthemove.com, and presumably if anybody goes on there, they can find out how they can hire old Ginny.
Absolutely, yeah, we've got contact Ginny. Information on there. You can get in touch. Absolutely.
Fantastic. So thank you so much to Cosmo Caddy and Claire Brumby. You've been listening to the Food Talk Show. I've managed to keep it going and not fall over my words too much, despite the fact I've drunk quite a lot of gin and some pretty hairy grass. And we're syndicated all across I can't be bothered to read that. Thank you to my fellow presenters, Guy Routledge of Sapling Digital and
That's
Food it. Rush.
Thanks
you so much, Guy. And
and the other guy.
No, the other bloke. With the beard that I'm next to. And if you're doing something groundbreaking in the food sector, please get in touch with us via Twitter on @FoodTalkShow. And if you want to listen to any of our hundreds of podcasts, go to foodtalk.co.uk. And very soon we'll be announcing our finalists of the Food Talk Awards. We've had hundreds of entries of some amazing, amazing things that have come in there. So I'm very, very excited about that. And that event is on the 15th of June. We'll let you know more about that. So have a good week now. Bye.